Mycroft! I knew those voices. I would have charged headlong across a battlefield to answer them. Now comes my confession, reader. In the crisis with Carlyle and Bridger, I forgot Martin completely, and did not think to check in with him until I was already in the car, soaring my way across the broad Pacific toward Togenkyo. My pretend affair with Thisbe was the only thing which saved me from questions I could not have answered. Martin was still at the house, combing the room for every hair and flake of skin that might identify the intruder, but finding nothing. After apologies, I asked Martin for fresh orders. I had not felt fear yet, reader. Not upstairs, not when I found the suspicious stolen paper, not when Martin came. Now, though, the command he gave made two vaguenesses congeal into one threat, distant, amorphous, but unmistakable, as when, against a background of city dawn and back-alley clatter, one click and one clack come together into the telltale click-clack of a ready gun. And echo won't tell you whether the enemy's perch is left or right or high or low, only that it is near. Go to Togenkyo. Chapter the Fourth. A Thing Long Thought Extinct. The simile of the three insects was originally about knowledge, not wealth. Our age's founding hero, Gordian Chairman Thomas Carlyle, stole the simile from Sir Francis Bacon, the founding hero of another age 500 years before. In Bacon's 1620 version, the ant was not yet the corporation, stripping land and people to hoard wealth within its vaults, but the encyclopedist, heaping knowledge into useless piles, adding nothing new. The spider was not yet the geographic nation, snaring wealth and helpless citizens within the net of its self-spun borders, but the dogmatist, spinning webs of philosophy out of the stuff of his own mind, without examining empirical reality. Bacon's ideal, his scientist, was then the honeybee, which harvests the fruits of nature and, processing them with its inborn powers, produces something good and useful for the world. Our Thomas Carlyle, genius thief, co-opted the simile in 2130 when he named the hive our modern union, its members united not by any accident of birth, but by shared culture, philosophy, and, most of all, by choice. Pundits may whine that hives were birthed by technology rather than Carlyle, an inevitable change ever since 2073, when Mukta circled the globe in 4.2 hours, bringing the whole planet within comfortable commuting range, and sounding the death knell of that old spider, the geographic nation. There is some truth to their claims, since it does not take a firebrand leader to make someone who lives in Maui, works in Myanmar, and lunches in Syracuse realize the absurdity of owing allegiance to the patch of dirt where babe first parted from placenta. But there is also a kind of truth the heart knows, and that is why our age of hives will not strip Thomas Carlyle of the founder's crown. Nor do I mean him any dishonor by calling him a thief. Hive is a stolen name, born from a stolen simile. But the three insects which Carlyle stole from Bacon, Bacon had in turn stolen from Petrarch, Petrarch from Seneca, and Seneca perhaps from some more ancient, swallowed since by time. There is no more shame in reusing such a rich inheritance than in knowing other kings' hands held this sword before you drew it from the stone. Night overtook me on my flight from Chile's coast to Indonesia, or rather, I overtook the night, racing in 2 hours so far around the planet's curve that I half caught up with tomorrow. Togenkyo's lights skitter far across the night-locked ocean. Boats like sparks schooling among the lines of reflected brightness which calligraph the waves for a kilometer around the island. Here, 7 perfect lotus blossoms rise against the sea, glowing from within with clean, warm light like happy ghosts and dusting the ground around their roots with shimmer. Only as the car curves down to land does the eye realize each petal is a skyscraper, blazing with commerce's neon fire, while the shimmer around their roots is the pulsing streetscape of a metropolis. It is a double compromise, this Mitsubishi capital, a compromise between the twin aesthetic loves of Eastern Asia, towers of glass and steel, and tranquil nature, and a compromise among the hive's 3 dominant nation strats, since China, Japan, and Korea all feared to let another host the capital, so the 3 agreed on neutral Indonesia as the hive's heart. The summons gave my car clearance to touch down on the eastmost tower of the westmost blossom, where the Mitsubishi Executive Directorate enjoys the best view of city and sea. My drab servicer uniform felt drabber in these hallways. As March became ever more a lamb, the Mitsubishi were showing their spring colors, time-sensitive dyes within the fabrics of suits. Hauri, Chaguri, and Chervani changing, so winter's deep hues brightened to cyans and yellows, while leaves and floral patterns bloomed through simple stripes like morning glories through their trellises. Perhaps you too have felt the itch of rebirth and festivity the Mitsubishi carry to every corner of the earth. Even in islands without seasons, or in Cielo de Pájaros, where March means summer's end, still we all liven with anticipation as the eastern cherries bloom. And why not? Maybe Earth's oldest living poetic tradition, the Asian cycle of plants and seasons, cannot be truly translated. But the cunning of fashion surpasses even language. It is spring in China, Korea, and Japan, so spring everywhere. Not the executive chamber, Mycroft, this way. I followed a soft-footed clerk, feeling fears prickle on my neck as we passed the meeting rooms and the computer lab where I was sometimes put to work, entering instead a Bosch apartment which sat above the chambers like the control room above a factory. The servicer you summoned has arrived, Director. Send them in. I removed my hat as I entered, which fear of recognition forced me to keep on, even in the corridor. We expect promptness when we call. Before the door had closed behind me, Chief Director Hotaka Ando Mitsubishi lashed me with harsh Japanese, which made my greeting bow into a cringe. Apologies, Chief Director. I should have fought harder to break away. I answered him in Japanese, and bowed anew with my apology, but dared raise my eyes enough to count the pairs of legs around me. There were 5 in the room, but 4 wore the familiar deep green of Mitsubishi guards, so for an audience with the chief director, we were practically alone. Black Sakura, you know what's happened? Partly, yes, Chief Director. I've been assigned to the case. I straightened now, and verified my fears. Directorate guards wear whatever cuts of Mitsubishi's suit jacket match their nation strats. Chinese, closed at the front with braided frogs, Korean tied across the chest like Chaguri, Indian long and buttoned like Sherwani, sometimes Western blazers, or the Japanese style, crossing at the front like kimono. Today, there was no such variety. All Japanese suits with Japanese faces, several familiar. Children of executives who held high office in the hive through Ando's patronage. This was an inner circle then, gathered for that special kind of meeting where, if there are bruises afterward, no one will dare ask why. The chief director himself stood in the center, Hotaka Ando Mitsubishi, to use the customary English ordering of his names. Today's suit was blue-black, with a pattern of plain reeds appearing for spring, fine cloth, but no finer than his guards, while his simple shoes and plain short haircut proclaim the supreme confidence of a ruler so secure he can afford to dress no better than his subjects. He was not always so. In our kind age, No face beside the mayor's is truly battle-hardened, but Chief Director Ando's is at least conflict-hardened. With a handsome severity earned over decades, battling to break the Chinese faction's hold on the Chief Director's chair. Even our anti-aging drugs, which keep the strength of 30 alive in him as he approaches 60, have not kept stress from silvering his temples. He addressed me in Japanese. But for you, good master, I shall render what I can in common English. The thief used the canner device. My tracker bleeped alarm as my pulse spiked. I don't have it, I cried. I don't have any idea where it is. I don't know anything. It was 13 years ago. I don't have the remotest connection to anyone who might have ended up with it. Only this far into my reflexive protest did I realize I was cowering, my arms bent over my head to stave off blows, although no guard had moved. Please believe me. I don't know anything. As Director Ando stared me down, I could read in his face the evidence against me massing, ready to draw into a phalanx, my presence at the house, my fingerprints on the paper. Where did you hide it? He asked. Where did you hide the device? Maybe there were two? Even I could hear the foolish desperation in my voice. There were not two. There was one. Who did you give it to? No one, Chief Director. No one. It couldn't have been the canner device. The words were as much for myself as the director. The device could swap tracker signals and make someone else's tracker register as if they were Occam Sinir, but it couldn't get through the rest of the security. I don't know what security Black Sakura has, but there are systems at the Sinir Weeksbooth Bash that nothing I know of could get through, certainly not the canner device. It was only for the tracker system, for swapping two signals, nothing else. It can't have been... Martin sent this to you, too. The Chief Director brought an image before my lenses. Martin's scan of the paper I had found in the trash that morning, which I had hardly glanced at among the many messages that had chased me through my ride. The reconstruction was meticulous, rendering the paper fiber by fiber, showing how it had indeed, as Martin said, been crumpled around something. In the next instant, the director filled in that something, the unmistakable, sleek, fish-like, tapered body of the infamous device which the hysterical public never should have named for me. You had it last, Ando accused. You know who has it now. I don't know. It was years ago. It'll have been sold on to someone else by now. Sold? Did you sell it to someone? No. Yes, I mean, sort of. I left it... Plausible-seeming lies multiplied in my imagination, but as I started to voice one, I could see Chief Director Ando's face tighten. It wasn't plausible. None of this was plausible. Least of all, my innocence, though innocent I was. I really don't know what happened to it. Please believe me. I was arrested. I don't know what happened after that. The police say the case for the device was empty when they found it, but anyone could have it. Crooked cops, organized crime, kids who stumbled on my hideout, anyone. You can't have been that reckless with it. I was a child. Ando did not need to do more than glare. Genuine faintness made it easy to fall to my knees before him. Please believe me, Chief Director, I don't know anything about what's happened. You know I have no way to prove my innocence, but you've trusted me a long time, and I've never betrayed that. I never would. Even this morning, I could have told Martin the truth about the 710 list, but I didn't. His glare changed. What truth? That Suneo Sugiyama didn't write that list. I saw the Chief Director flinch, and I clung to the new topic like a lifeline. Sugiyama always writes Black Sakura's 710 list, but they think the pen should be wielded like a sword, especially the most publicized article of the year. Sugiyama would never have produced anything so uncontroversial, and when they listed the top seven, they would never have referred to you as Hotaka Mitsubishi. They would have included your birth bash name. Hotaka Ando Mitsubishi hissed under his breath, and my tracker stopped worrying about my heart rate. Masami Mitsubishi wrote this list, didn't they, Director? I tested.